This is the Hockey News Podcast.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Hockey News Podcast. I'm your host, Edward Fraser. I guess I'm somewhat filling in for Ken Campbell this week. Not that he hosts, but Ken is actually down in the Dominion. He's at Andrew and Julie's wedding down there, so congrats to them. I'm sure I'm sure some people will be happy with the 100% less Ken on the podcast.
Not us, no, that's silence. It's and the lack of Ken.
It's also 100% less name brand cola.
That's right.
Popping off the top of the podcast and driving me up the wall.
Yeah, Ken. We may as well rip Ken. Like, Ken's not here, so we should just rip him a little bit.
He's not going to listen.
Yeah, the Coke bit, like, it's so played out. Don't you think?
Oh, I do one of these podcasts every couple of months. I don't think I've done one for a couple of months, and it was driving me nuts back then. If he's still doing it, I don't know how you guys don't strangle him.
I feel it's almost postmodern at this point.
He's become a parody of himself.
Yeah.
It's like a Family Guy joke where he's like, exactly. he just keeps going like, and it's not funny, but now it's funny. So
yeah, it's Sideshow Bob stepping on the rigs.
Ken is Peter, and the Coke can is a frog trying to get out the window on the wall. Anyways, all right, let's get into the hockey news this week. Let's start off with Dylan Strome getting a recall from the AHL. I think a lot of Coyotes fans are saying finally, but does he stick this time?
I think he has all the attributes to do it, and it's funny. People were worried about Dylan Strome. People are even already saying, "Oh, he's a bust." But I mean, he's a big young center, and those types of players always take a little bit longer to reach their maturation. And going to Tucson, I think, was the best thing for him because he went down, he dominated, he did exactly what they wanted him to, he put up a ton of points, and in the meantime, Arizona actually started winning some hockey games. So now when he comes up, the pressure is a little bit muted. He doesn't have to save the franchise or anything like that. He can be part of the collective, he can work his way into the lineup, earn minutes, you know, he can follow Rick Tocchet's address, and I think this is the proper situation for him. And you know, he doesn't need to put up a ton of points right away. He needs to get his feet wet and establish himself. And you know, I've spoken to Strome numerous times in the past, and one of the most enlightened things he ever told me was the first time he got sent back to junior, he said, "Look, I don't plan on being in the NHL for 1 year. I want to be in the NHL for like 10 or 15 years. And I've only just had my first crack. I know that it's going to be a long process. I'm prepared for that." So we know he wants to put in the work, and he's been listening, and this is his chance, and it'll be fun to see what he can do.
The expectations were incredibly high on this kid, and I think that's part of the reason why people were starting to chatter about him being a bust. I don't think if organizations such as ourselves had been putting him top five in future Rush rankings, was he number one year, if I recall correctly?
Or, well, he might have used at least top two.
Top two, yeah. So the expectations were huge. So the fact that when these guys, because you see guys coming in right off the hop, the McDavids, the Matthews, but Strome is not a McDavid or a Matthew, and I think some people don't realize that when you're picked fairly high and you get hyped in future watch, there comes the expectations. But have these been tempered now, and can he kind of perform with less pressure?
I think they've been tempered, and I think it's a good point about the expectations because he was drafted directly after Connor McDavid and Jack Eichel, so there's a natural tendency to compare him to those two, but there's a huge drop-off between 2 and 3 in that draft year, and what people have to remember is this is Dylan Strome's first year of extended professional hockey, and that includes the AHL. He was still a major junior last year. So I think it was really smart, especially in hindsight, of the Coyotes to give him a chance to breathe and feel that pressure go away. And the situation he's coming back to is very different to what it was even 2 months ago. 2 months ago, people thought, I thought at least, the Coyotes might have been on the fringe of playoff contention. They thought Strome was a key piece to the puzzle for this season. Now he's coming back to a team that, yes, is starting to win a lot more, but is way out of the playoff race. Yeah. There's no pressure. Clayton Keller's already established himself as one of the top Calder Trophy favorites. He's playing so well, it's going to attract a lot of attention away from Strome. And also, there's no center on the team that's been playing great. Not even Derek Stepan has been playing great so far, at least offensively. So this team, they could use him. And I think he has a chance. Like, he might get some power play time. He might be able to put up numbers right away. But even if he doesn't, I don't think it's going to matter nearly as much as it would have if he was in the lineup from October 1st onward, and they were really needing him to win games for them.
Is it crisis averted in Arizona at this point? Because, I mean, there was talk, got to get Chake out of here, we got to go in another direction, this isn't working. But they've been a much, much, much improved team. So is the fire no longer under the team in the brass?
I think that's fair, because if you look at that awful start they got off to, the big problem was goaltending. You know, Raanta was hurt, they didn't have the organizational depth to cover up for it, and it was a really big piece of the puzzle. Like, again, like, none of us expected them to be a contender this year. We thought they would be better, but if you take away goaltending for a team that's still finding itself, that made some big moves in the offseason, like, it just wasn't there. And you have a new coach, so you're learning new systems. I think it's too bad for them that it's already a lost season. But at least now they can kind of reset and say, let's just see what we have here. Let's learn Tocchet's system. Let's get to know each other. Let's bring in guys like Strome and see what they can do. And they have some other young players that are doing very well in the minors as well. Lawson Krause is playing pretty well. Nick Merkley's playing really well. So maybe as the season goes on, you shuffle these guys through the lineup and see what they've got. I mean, Krause has been up before, but you have that luxury now. And I think Shaika, at least as you got to give him another year or two to really see the thing through, because the elite players that he's drafted are just on the cusp. They're not there yet.
I think there was a lot of pressure on this team, too, because there was expectations. Bringing in Hjalmarsson, bringing in Raanta. You know, this is a team that was supposed to win now, not win a Stanley Cup, but win more games than they lost. So I think that that was shackling them in the beginning, but now the pressure's off a little bit. Now the season, like you said, is lost, and this is a team that's kind of starting to play up to where they should be.
Yeah, I think Arizona was the splashiest team in the offseason other than the Dallas Stars. They made a lot of moves. They fundamentally changed their roster. So there was the expectation, not necessarily, like you said, Ed, of Stanley Cup or even playoffs, but of progress. So I think there still is something to cheer for the rest of the year if you're a Coyotes fan, and it's progress. It's something better than last year. If the team's moving in the right direction, then it's a good sign. And it's something that if you're, let's say, a Buffalo Sabres fan, you're looking for that too, and you're not seeing it this year, I think that's a team that should be concerned, because it's not always that making the playoffs is the goal for the rebuilding team, but you still want to see the arrow slowly moving forward, not backward.
And at least maybe you can get lucky in the lottery and pick up yet another high draft pick as well. Matthew Tkachuk. Edit again. Guys, getting frustrated with him. Gabriel Landeskog, the latest. How many games does Mr. Landeskog deserve, if any, for his cross-check?
I think he's going to get multiple games. Technically, so to be a repeat offender under the CBA, it's got to be 18 months, and Landeskog's last suspension was March of 2016, which is, I believe, 20 months, if my math is right. So he's technically not a repeat offender, but there has been some precedent for sort of making an exception, saying, oh, come on, it's pretty close. And one of Landeskog's prior suspensions was for a cross-check, and so the DLPS will pay attention to that, because if you're repeating the same bad behavior, it's an especially big no-no. He wasn't offered an in-person hearing, so it should be fewer than 5 games, but I think it's going to be multiple games. And by the time you guys are listening to this, there's a chance that the ruling's already come out. I'm going to say 4 games for Landeskog.
Okay, but does he deserve it?
For me, I feel like maybe a 1 or 2 game suspension was what I was thinking. Matt's better in the discipline department when it comes to numbers and things like that. Yeah, I don't know why, but in my head, because it was multiple cross checks and only the last one hit his head, I'm sort of like, well, I don't know if he meant to hit him in the head, but he still did, and you have to be responsible for your actions. So in my mind, I think you do have to send that message, particularly in this climate of headshots. So that would be my thing, because I feel like it's going to be 2 games.
The Avs obviously are going to miss Landeskog. The Avs as a whole, though, way playing over expectations. What's been key for their success this year?
I think some of it is puck luck. I'm sorry to poo-poo on the parade, but if you fire up Corsica.hockey and go check out the analytics, Colorado's still not looking too good, so I'm still expecting a bit of a regression As a team, they still generate far fewer chances than they give up. But I will say, a lot of the kids are playing much better. Nathan McKinnon, a guy who I've been tough on, because I keep saying I'm waiting to see that breakout after his best season was his rookie season, and now you're finally seeing it. The last I checked, as of a few days ago, McKinnon was on pace for 100 points. And it's easy to forget that he's still only 22 years old. Like, he's the same age, I think, as Will Butcher, who's a rookie.
Yeah, very possible.
Yeah, so that kind of puts it in perspective. There's still a lot of time for McKinnon to turn it around. And I know Ryan has always been a big supporter, defender of McKinnon. So maybe I was wrong. Maybe Ryan's right.
Well, I've always been a big detractor of McKinnon because I thought he was one of the best players of working himself into good position only to shovel the puck into the center of the goalie's crest. But as Ryan, and I thought it was a really good point you made this year, he's morphed his game into a bit of a playmaker this year.
Yeah, he's shooting less than he did last year, and his primary assists are way up, which is interesting. And it's funny, when you talk about analytics, you're right about Corsi, but their PDO, the last time I checked, was 99.9, which essentially is right where it should be. So in terms of shooting and save percentage, they're the actual puck luck, they're fine on. But I know what you're saying about the possession numbers.
Right.
It is interesting, like, you know, with McKinnon and Rantanen, and they had been playing with Landeskog, it seemed like a really nice combination there. And it's funny, there's no one sniper on the Avs right now. They're really scoring by committee, and they're, you know, the defense is getting in on it, and then, like, Neil Yakupov is putting up points, which for me is fun because, like, I've always been a Yakupov fan.
Edward's laughing right now. Just the mention of Yakupov and points.
Right. Yeah, because he's always, I don't know, I've always had fun talking to him. He's always been a great kid, and, you know, and speaking of a guy that had to go through high expectations,
oh, yeah,
that he's had a lot of problems living up to. It's nice to see him scoring more. And, I'm not sure what the end game is for the Avs, but, I mean, I think we all thought they were going to be left for dead this year, and that has certainly not been the case.
Well, especially after last season. If the Avs are going to be successful, maybe they need some kind of a scorer. Maybe somebody like a Matt Duchene or something like that. I don't know. No, that was a good deal. Sackett did very well there. I don't think any of us are kidding ourselves into thinking the Avs are for real in a cup contender sense. A team that is for real, and I'm saying it. I'm not going to ask this question. I'm going to say they are for real. I'm going to say it.
That's bold.
So I'm not going to ask you, are they for real? I'm going to ask you why the St. Louis Blues are real.
Loaded question. I'm going to say the Blues are kind of for real. I do think everything they've done well is legit. I think Braden Schenn is a legitimate number one center. And we know who Tarasenko is, and there's amazing chemistry on that top line. And Alex Pietrangelo is a legitimate Norris Trophy contender. I think you're seeing a lot of good there. But I still think this team's a bit top-heavy. It's a bit vulnerable if anything happens to that anybody from that top line. You still have Robbie Fabry out for the year. Patrick Berglund will come back soon, very soon, any day now, which will help. But even on the blue line, like, Joel Edmondson's got 6 goals. I think in his entire AHL career, he had eight goals. That's a bit fluky, and you need more goals from Colton Parayko. Everyone loves this big shot. Oh, he's going to be Shea Weber. He's got 2 goals. So I still think they're getting a bit too much scoring from the one big line. And Jake Allen has returned to being just okay in net. And last season down the stretch, he was as good as any goaltender. And he single-handedly won them a playoff series. But last I checked, his save percentage was about .908. And it seems like that means that Allen's regressing into that sort of tweener starter territory. So I'm not totally convinced. I think they're going to be good. They're going to be a playoff team. But I think they're going to get passed by a better contender as the season progresses.
But just remember, Martin Brodeur is only a call away to come back down and right the ship with Allen, and he'll heat up again. I think he's a better goalie than 908, I'll tell you that much. Your thoughts on the Blues, Ryan?
Yeah, I'm a fan. I said it earlier. I think it was in the podcast that didn't air that the St. Louis Blues. But
yeah, you did.
But you'll back me up on this.
The Blues to win the Cup.
I said the Blues could win the Cup this year. And the reason I like it is, they have a really nice assortment of forwards. They have some very good defensemen. And with Jake Allen, I think he's, you know, he can get on those runs where he can be elite. So it's just a matter of, you know, being consistent. But I like their depth, even though they haven't used it necessarily yet. Like, I think St. Louis has one of the best pipelines going right now. And it's a pipeline that's pretty ripe. They've got players that they can bring up and down that can contribute. I know, like, Samuel Blaze got his first NHL goal the other day. You know, like Tage Thompson has only played a handful of games, but you know he can come up. They've got, you know, Dmitry Yaskin. They've got Ivan Barbashev. I mean, like Klim Kostin is still a teenager, but you know if you had to, you could give him a shot. You know, Vince Dunn on defense if you needed him. I mean, so far they haven't necessarily needed contributions from any of these kids. But I like that kind of security blanket where you can move guys up. You've got internal competition. So, you know, for players, you can sort of say, like, well, no job is safe on those bottom lines. Like, you got to make sure you perform because we've got guys sort of nipping at your heels. And Patrick Berglund's not even there yet. So there's another player coming in. And, you know, they're not necessarily a team that has a lot of marquee names. Like, Tarasenko, obviously, would be their, like, star/superstar. But, you know, under Mike Yeo, they just seem to be in a good place, and I just like the whole sort of complement they have.
I could also very much see Doug Armstrong making a move with this team because, you know, they're a team, lots of playoff failures, but you got to capitalize now, and I think when the West is a bit of a mushy middle, I think I'm fair in saying that, maybe this is the year where you try to strike, where, you know, Chicago's having a bit of a down year. Nashville, we don't really know what they are yet. You know, can you kind of go down the list? But I think St. Louis could make an ad. And like you said, they've got the pipeline if they need to deal off an asset to get some kind of a rental, not that the market's that hot. But, Maddie, if you don't like St. Louis as the best team in the West, I'll put you on the spot. Who is the top team?
Oh, it's a great question. I agree that the West has been pretty mushy this year. I like the way the Predators are playing of late. They might be my pick for the rest of the season. I mean, the Jets have been really good, but the Jets have been very reliant on goaltending. How weird is that?
Yes,
The underlying numbers say that they're due for a bit of regression, too. I don't know. I mean, right now, I do think the Blues, they are the best team in the West. I don't think that necessarily means they're a Stanley Cup contender, because I think the best teams are in the East right now. And I think Tampa Bay is still lording over everyone else. So is Columbus. I think those two teams are the teams that would scare me the most. But yeah, you know, I do think the Blues, if Doug Armstrong decides to make a move, and I could see it happening, maybe they do get a crucial upgrade. I think they're going to wait, because for now, Patrick Berglund is the equivalent of a free acquisition. Mm-hmm. They're going to see how the lineup plays out after that. But come March, if they're still this high in the standings, they're going to realize they have a window and they want to maximize Tarasenko's prime years. I could see them upgrading, and then maybe they're very legitimate as a contender.
I like your point about the Preds, though, like, because we haven't seen Ryan Ellis yet. Turris, you know, he's still got some time to acclimatize into that lineup, but they're looking pretty darn good. I kind of like the Preds for a return as well. Ryan, before we move on, I want to get your thoughts on Nashville and specifically their goaltending situation. Do you think Pekka Rinne can hold up, especially on the road where he was absolutely dreadful last year?
Well, that to me is like the big X factor, because so far, I mean, he's been playing really well. And unfortunately, this is one of those situations where you kind of have to wait until you're in it to say. So I think what would obviously be best for the Preds is for him to get tested early in the playoffs and have some success, so that sort of mental block goes away. It's interesting because, you know, we talk about this being a young man's league. But when it comes to goaltending, it feels like that's a bit more of an amorphous concept where you can be older and still have success. I mean, Roberto Luongo is playing incredible this year. So it's a bit of a different story. But, I mean, if guys can figure out Rinne, then that's a problem. But I think he's proven so far this year that he's still got some game in him.
And the funny thing about Rinne, the home road splits, it's not like that was a fluky thing for the 2017 playoffs. I remember I crunched those numbers, and it's his entire career, beginning to end, very drastic home road splits. So that's a problem that it seems like it's going to follow Rinne around. And if it doesn't follow him to this year's playoffs, that will be the anomaly, which is strange to say, but it's true.
I also think it behooves them. As it behooves me to use the word behooves.
Yes. I don't know what the word means. I hear it used all the time. I don't know what it means.
it would serve them well to do so.
Exactly.
All right. The more you know.
UC Saros, seeing a bunch of ice time. You know, I don't think they need to race up the standings. I think even if it means them losing a couple of games, I think Rinne getting some rest. Because, I mean, he's the clear number one going into the playoffs. So I think a rested Rinne. Delicious, by the way. Arrested Rinne.
Yeah.
Roasted Rested Rene is one of my favorite.
Pecorino cheese?
Sorry. the Montreal Canadiens. Carey Price is back. Montreal fans are, for the time being, not absolutely losing their minds and asking for heads to be put on pikes. But can they get back in it? Can they rebound now that he's back?
Well, I mean, given that they're in the Atlantic Division, I think the answer is yes. It's so wide open after the Lightning and the Leafs that if they can put together a run, they'll at least be in the hunt. And then it just becomes a matter of, you know, do they have any legs for the playoffs? Are they built so that they could win a series or two? And really that, again, will come down to Price. Is he going to face a team that knows how to solve him? And, you know, a couple of years ago, maybe we would have said, like, oh, no, he's the most intimidating goalie around. But I think that's changed a little bit. But he's definitely going to have all the motivation in the world to get this team back on top. And I think it's going to be interesting to see what he can do in, say, the next month and if he can get back to being that Carey Price we've been used to.
Yeah, I believe in it. And it's a great point about the Atlantic. If you think of it this way, it's, okay, Montreal, your mission is to win a bunch of games against Buffalo, Florida, and Detroit. Okay, yeah. No problem. And I do think we've seen time and again over the past few seasons, it's very drastic, the contrast between with Price in the lineup, with Price out of the lineup. Montreal is often a first-place dominant team when Price is in there. That's how big the difference is. So if he can find himself, I think they're going to start winning games. And even if he is just average and not his superhuman self, the possession numbers, the analytics suggested that Montreal's been very unlucky. They've been one of the better possession teams in the league. And at least the last time I checked, their PDO was, I think it was bottom of the barrel. Very unlucky. So that's going to start regressing in their favor. And if Price is back in the lineup, you could see the Habs go on a run. And they have been a very streaky team year to year. We've seen it, I don't know how many years in a row, but they go on one of these big runs. Usually it's in October, but maybe this year it's going to be a December run or a January run.
But I get the numbers. I get what they say. But the reason that this team is so much more successful with Price in the lineup than when without is because this is a flawed hockey club. They have a lot of shortcomings. So they need to, if they're going to make a serious run out of the East, and I don't think they have much hope, because even though you're in a crappy division, you still got to get past Tampa or Toronto before you even get out of your division. I guess you can play the wild card and come out of the Metro. But anyways, does Bergevin feel additional pressure to make a move to save his job if this team is at all in the hunt to try to make a deep playoff run to keep the Crows at bay?
I feel that if he hasn't been fired yet, then he's probably not going to get fired this year, because let's assume that they are a middling team for the rest of the season. If they make the playoffs, then they've kind of met expectations in a weird way. I don't know. It's tough to say, like, with owner Jeff Molson what his expectations were. I'm sure they were pretty high. But I'm sure he also recognizes at this point that this roster needs some work. Now, if I'm Mark Bergevin, I say, well, let me fix the problem that I've created. And let me start this.
Said out. Every man forever, always.
Yeah, exactly. But you know what? I mean, if Molson and Bergevin have a pretty good relationship, then he'll give him that opportunity. And yeah, it's an interesting situation, but if you believe that you can win based off goaltending, then I don't know. I mean, I don't see it.
Yeah.
But it seems like Montreal brass has a particular vision, and they're willing to make big deals to do it. And I mean, like I said, Bergevin's still there, so there must be something to that.
I don't think he's getting canned midseason. I think you're right. If he was going to be gone, he'd be gone. I just worry about the offseason for him and whether or not he survives the summer, and you know whether Molson has faith in him or not. A playoff berth is the minimum, but I don't think you start dealing away assets for this team, because you signed Carey Price to be your goaltender for the next 8 years. Yes, eight years.
Eight years.
So they don't got to win this year. You know, they just have to win sometime within his window. I mean,
they have to win a year.
They have to win one of the years. I mean, yeah. And okay, before the decline begins, so I guess you got about a 5-year window. But you can't sacrifice to win now when you're not a team that's ready to win now.
Yeah, and I think, if I remember correctly, they did win the division last year, right? And, yep. And then you sign Carl Alsner, you lose Alexander Radulov, you let Andre Markov walk from Mark Street, you trade Jonathan Drouin, or trade Mikhail Sergachev for Jonathan Drouin, you sign Price to the huge extension, it all blows up in your face. The blood is all over Mark Bergevin's hands. If they miss the playoffs this year, I absolutely think Bergevin loses his job. So I don't necessarily agree with Ryan on that. I think Bergevin is absolutely in desperation mode right now. And if I'm him, I'm scrambling to make another move to try and upgrade this team. To me, it jumps out at me. Just call up Bob Murray, offer Alex Galchenyuk, who evidently you don't want because you're trying to trash Galchenyuk publicly every chance you get. Offer him to the Ducks for Sami Vatanen. You need a puck mover because you've lost Andre Markov. You finally have a puck mover back on defense. And if you're not going to make the most of Galchenyuk anyways, send him to a team that could use a good young forward like Anaheim. Mm-hmm.
Reader questions times. Jeremy K. Gover at Gover Time.
Yeah, Gover? Gover, yeah. I thought it was Glover. But
that's a bit of a weird one.
Or is it Gover as in Gover Time?
Gover Time.
Like overtime, but Gover Time.
I think we just gave him a nickname.
I'm going Gover. All right. Yeah, I think you got it right. All right. He asks, what quote unquote class of star would you put Philip Forsberg in? AKA superstar, emerging superstar, star, borderline all star, etc. So I guess you have to use star because the question is about star.
True. And I would say star. I don't think he's a superstar. He's never had more than – I don't think he's hit the 65-point plateau. He's broken 60 points twice, and that's very good. But I feel like to be a superstar, you got to get up into that like 85 to 90-point range these days. I mean, not a lot of people get 100 points. But you need a little more than that. And I think, you know, as for emerging superstar, I think Philip Forsberg's, he's in his prime right now. And he's, you know, he's very, very good. And on a team like Nashville, where they have that great defense core and they kind of just have a lot of really good players, you know, he is definitely one of the standout forwards, but I'm comfortable with calling him a star.
I, for the most part, agree. I think he's in the star tier. I think he's got one more echelon he can possibly climb to. He's still in his early 20s. And the thing with Forsberg is the end of season numbers have been the same, but last year he had, I think it was 2 goals in his first 20 games or something like that, and he scored almost like a superstar goal scorer for the last 2/3 of the season. So for Forsberg, the thing is, can he finally put it together and be consistent for an entire 82-game schedule? And if he does, you could see him score 35 or 40 goals and crack 70 points. And then I think he's a tier above star, not superstar. But I don't know, what's between star and superstar? Big star?
Yeah, I get what you're saying, yeah. Though, because to me, there's only 5 superstars in the league at any one time. And yeah. I don't think he's in there with the McDavids and the Matthews and the Tavares. But he's a very good player.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely.
And I want to just give us a little pat on the back for not throwing George McPhee under the bus. I did it by breaking it up.
And also,
you just did it.
Back pat for us in the 2012 draft, in our draft preview, we ranked Phil Forsberg 2nd. That's overall, right. He was picked 11th, I believe, but we had him number 2.
Yeah.
Just saying.
That's got to be the worst trade of all time. It has to be.
Probably. Well, definitely worst modern trade, because I know, like, Phil Esposito got traded for, like, Pitt Martin one time, and that didn't go well. It was, like, a multiplayer deal that really killed the one team.
And it was so bad. Like, it's got to be the worst trade in the sense of the day it happened, the second it happened, it was, oh my God, what a terrible trade. And that was before Forsberg had even played in the NHL.
Yeah.
And I that summer I asked David Poile about it, and I said, come on, you must have been pretty happy when you got that trade. And he was very defensive. He was like, no. he said his main stance was, it was a horrible day. We lost Martin Irat, but okay.
Yeah.
Okay, whatever you say, Mr. Poile.
I don't see David Poile as a dancing man, but I'm guessing he did a little dance. And you know what? George McPhee, fantastic GM.
Yeah.
Look what he's done with Vegas.
Yeah.
Just had an off day.
Yeah, you know, it happens.
Our old friend Ayush, former intern Ayush. Come through the question. How you doing, buddy? Hope all is well with you. He is asking if Florida is regretting letting Marchessault go yet, and can they still turn their season around? Was he a Panthers fan? I'm starting to think.
No, we did have another intern. That's Mo Cranker. Hey, Mo. What's up, Mo?
I remember Rory, Panthers fan. Mm-hmm. Poor Rory. Hey, Rory, how you doing? Hope Sportsnet's treating you well. Can Florida turn it around?
Again, they're in the Atlantic. So, sure, why not? I mean,
because Atlantic.
Because they're in the Atlantic, although they're a little further down. Yeah, I think they miss Marchessault. And you look at the talent they have with Barkov and Trocheck down the middle. And, you know, it's a depth thing. I mean, if you can get a guy that can give you that instant offense, I don't see why. And that was a pretty curious one, you know. But Marchessault has been given up on by a couple of organizations already, and it hasn't, hasn't slowed him down. He's used it. He's got a chip on his shoulder that he has turned into a positive thing. And, yeah, obviously Vegas is happy that Florida made that decision.
Any thoughts as to why Florida allowed this guy to get away?
It's funny. My answer is that there's no answer. It's truly dumbfounding. Unless there's something we don't know, a behind-the-scenes character issue for Marchessault, it's the only possible explanation. It's not to accuse Marchessault of anything. I mean it more as a compliment to him, because I don't see why any team would want to walk away from him. He just had his first 30-goal season. He's got a great low price tag right now until his next contract next year. And the Panthers, to me, had the most confounding offseason. They also let go of Riley Smith, and they didn't re-sign Jaromir Jagr, and Rabada's been okay. Dadanov's been very good, I'll give them that. But they're left with this sort of influx roster where you have a lot of youth kind of transitioning into the lineup. Owen Tippett got his chance. Jared McCann's getting some playing time. They're hoping that Henrik Hapola is a thing. So far, he's not. The defense corps, I mean, Michael Matheson, I like him a lot, but again, you're relying on him and Ian McCaution and a lot of youth back there. I don't know. I think that they're kind of stuck in transition, and it is nice to see Alexander Barkov finally healthy for now. He still hasn't had one full healthy season yet. But when he's in the lineup, he's the new Kopitar. He's fantastic. But overall, I'm skeptical. I think they've just... It's a shame, because 2 years ago, they were heading in the right direction. They had a franchise record in points, but they just decided, you know what? Let's change this whole roster for no reason, and look what's happened. Yeah.
Ernie Morris asks, what do you make of Chiarelli scouting Columbus games? Something brewing there. Seems like Yarmo is trying to aggressively add, but I don't get the sense anything is close. What say you? We'll start with you, Matt.
It's not official, but I mean, I've heard a lot of rumors about it, and you see it on Twitter, and it kind of makes sense. It is the idea of Columbus pursuing Ryan Nugent-Hopkins and the Oilers looking for some defense help. I like the idea more for Columbus than I do for Edmonton. The news, he's proven himself to be a decent two-way center. He still has the offensive skills. He hasn't reached the potential that you'd think of that would befit a first overall pick, but he's still a useful guy. The Oilers, I mean, the rumor I heard was Ryan Murray for Nugent-Hopkins, mm-hmm. but the Oilers, with getting Andre Sequeira back, I mean, I don't think you need to look for another defenseman in that tier, which is what Ryan Murray is. If the Oilers are going to acquire defensive help, it has to be a marquee guy. And I don't know. So far, subtracting from last year's group has not worked well. I mean, Eberle's playing much better with the Islanders than Strome is with the Oilers. So I don't know. I don't love the idea of trading Nugent-Hopkins right now for the Oilers.
Yeah, and the other consideration is sometimes GMs just playing these trips. You know, months in advance, they want to see different rinks, they want to see different people. So it could just be a matter of he was going to be there.
But do you doubt that Columbus is in buy mode?
Well, I definitely think they are in their window to win. And I don't know. I mean, thinking about the Columbus pipeline, like, they've certainly got some good players. But I don't know how much you want to mess with a good thing right now, because it's really come together for them. They're not an old team. It took them a while to figure out some of their line combinations. That's probably still a work in progress. But when you have guys like Pierre-Luc Dubois and Josh Anderson stepping up and having some success and you know, buying into Tortorella's system, then that's a big bonus. And yeah, I'm not sure if, like, do you make a move for the sake of making a move? That would be my only question.
I think the main question they have to answer, and it's tough to answer right now because he's hurt, is Alexander Wennberg a true number one center, or is he a really good number two center? Yeah. He's been in the number one role, but I think the one piece Columbus has to have if it wants to win the Cup is that dominating center. So the question is, if one becomes available, do you consider shopping a prospect who's not in the NHL or a guy who's on his way up, like Oliver Bjorkstrand? Do you sacrifice someone like that to get that marquee guy? It's too early to know because we don't know who's going to be available yet. Like, we can't say John Tavares because the Islanders are, 14-7-2? But Columbus has to figure that out. That's what Jarmo Kekalainen has to find out. Does he already have that number one guy?
But is RNH that guy if Wennberg's not?
No, he's not. That's a good point. I think he's actually kind of a pretty similar game.
I was going to say, they're kind of on the same level there. Yeah, even if they don't play specifically the same game, I would put them kind of on the same tier. Yes. Maybe Wennberg's a little higher.
2A and 2B.
Yeah.
I mean, you can get away with that to a degree, but yeah, no, I mean, the problem is you've got to give something up pretty significant if you're going to get a real, true number one. Yeah. And I don't think they're giving away any of those big D-men they've got. Final question from Seamus McGangsta.
Whoa, what a name.
Name of the day?
Is he a rapper from Dublin?
I like it. Can we figure out a way to make teams stop going over and back the opposing team's blue line in overtime? It's turning what should be exciting hockey into a snooze fest. And I get what he's saying, because I mean, the name of the game in overtime is possession, but it is getting a little bit silly when they can't find something else, they just cycle it back. But can you do something to prevent that?
I don't think you can. It's just the nature of the sport. Whenever there's a change that brings in offense, defense will always adjust. Doesn't matter what it is, they'll always find a way to smother because it's just the way the hockey mind works. You want to thwart the other team's chances. And I think to defend the over and back, in this case, it's trying to generate offense. It's teams saying, okay, we don't have the angles. Let's reset and come back to our own zone, then start another rush with speed to try and create openings. So to me, it might appear defensive because you are killing time when you're doubling back. But I still think the goal of that maneuver is offense. So I'm okay with it.
Yeah, you're opening up lanes. It's actually kind of it's an old Soviet technique. And if you talk to Russian players, maybe more so in the past than now, I'm not sure, but you know, they'll say the thing that always struck them about North American hockey was the dump and chase. They're like, why would you give the puck up when you already have it? And I think that really comes into focus with 3-on-3, because if you don't have the puck, it's a lot harder to defend because you have so much open ice. So I don't mind it. I get the time-wasting thing, and it may seem like a step back, but I feel it's more like a counterattack in a way where you regroup and then you're going right back in, because once those chances start in 3-on-3, they tend to go kind of like boom, 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 and that's the fun part. So that's if you right. got to regroup to do it, it's better than a whistle leading to a face-off. So that's my opinion.
Well, the thing is, you got to give offense to get offense. Wait a second, that doesn't make sense.
Wait,
you got to give offense to get
more offense.
Yeah, well, I mean, my point being,
you got to take a risk,
spend money to make money.
You got to take a risk that to get those opportunities going back and forth. You have to one team's got to take a risk,
yes.
And a lot of times because of the nature is that you're always going to fall back in that defensive position rather than take the risk, because it's more likely your puck's going to end up in the back of your net than you actually putting in the puck in the opposition. So if, as you say, teams continue to figure out how to defend 3-on-3, we can't go 2-on-2, we can't go shootout, do they extend overtime? Because, I mean, in 10 minutes, you're probably going to get a resolution to the game.
Yeah.
So if we start seeing more and more shootouts, is that the next logical step?
Well, I'm glad you mentioned that, Ed, because last year at the All-Star game, I went around and asked a whole bunch of the players that exact question: would you guys want to do 10-minute 3-on-3, and most of them said yes, except for Tyler Seguin, because he said, we suck at 3-on-3. He said no. But then the guy who was most in favor of it, who loved the idea, was Nathan MacKinnon. He was like, oh, yeah, for sure, the games would be over, most of the games would end, almost every game would end, if already there's tons ending in 3-on-3.
Mm-hmm.
In 5 minutes, almost every game would end in 10 minutes, and it seemed like the response was, it was just a sampling, but it was a sampling of, you know, big-name players, the guys who were on the ice for 3-on-3. And it was almost universally accepted as a cool idea.
You got to start getting deeper into your bench, too, if you go that. And that's, you know, I think when you start seeing, I mean, we see it across leagues, and you see it on teams as well. When you start getting into those lesser players, you're going to start seeing a less defensive acumen, I think, and maybe some more offense going back either ways. Well, that's a podcast for this week. Thanks everybody out there for listening. For Matt Larkin and Ryan Kennedy, I'm Edward Fraser. We'll see you next week.